right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight we are doing another one of our live broadcasts. So if you're out there listening on ustream.tv, you're hearing this live on Sunday night. The rest of you will have to listen to it when we post it. You can be a part of the live broadcast in two ways. You can listen to them on Ustream, or you can actually call in, and you can call in by using Skype. You just need to add Mormon Expression as your friend, and then just give me a ring during the middle of the podcast, and we will fold you into this luscious group that we have here tonight. All right, so let's before we go on with other announcements, let's introduce our illustrious panel. First of all, we have Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome back.
Hi, glad to be here.
All right, well, Chris, you need to give us a little bit about who you are.
My name is Chris. I resigned 4 years ago because I was a very literal black and white, it's all true or it's all false kind of thinker. Since then, I hope I relaxed a little bit.
You have.
Robin's seen me relax a little bit.
Definitely. And how about, tell him how you handed in your resignation, if you don't mind sharing. I think it's an awesome thing to add.
My husband and I read and kept on trying to find the answers and the answers that would keep us faithful. And finally realized that the all truth or all false had to come to a stop somewhere. And it came to a head when I had to speak in sacrament meeting and I didn't know what to talk about because I couldn't lie. I'm an all true kind of person. And, so I did the very best I could. And at the end of my talk, I bore my testimony to my boys and I said, listen to me because they were pretty young. It's going to be okay. Heavenly Father loves us. We don't know what's going to happen next, but it'll be okay. And everyone told me that they felt the spirit and it was beautiful. And right at the end of it, we handed our letters to the bishopric and haven't been back. That was 4 years ago.
All right. Well, welcome back. You were with us on the first inaugural book club with Levi Peterson's book, right?
Yep.
And you're back for some more.
Woohoo.
All right. And then we have the intrepid Robin. Hey, Robin.
Ooh, you used intrepid for me. And by the way, John, every time you call this lovely place where we meet the Den of Iniquity, I get a little chill. Because I think you're paying homage to me. Although someone may have suggested it first, but I still like to claim it for my own.
Well, claim away.
Okay.
Anything you want to say?
Well, I left the church 3 years and 8 months ago. And it's interesting because my story changes almost every time I tell it because where I am in my life seems to draw a different focus. But I'll just say I have not stepped foot back in my chapel. Oh, until today, by the way, but that's a story for a much later time. For 3 years and 8 months. And I'm just so happy to be here.
All right. Well, the three of us are going to bring it down with the book. So let's see. What announcements do I have before that? Our next live... I'm not sure what our next live broadcast is. Check out the schedule on ustream.tv and you can find out, you know, search for Mormon Expression there. You can see which ones we're doing live. I know coming up here is conference, but we're not doing that live. Let's see. Remember the cruise on the 27th? Now, we're having a little, between you and me, we're having a little bit of trouble with our travel agency. So if you're interested in going on the cruise, you can just contact me at john@mormonexpression.com and I will make sure that everything gets squared up. And hopefully we'll have our troubles ironed out in about a week and then that will all be squared away. As do we have anything else? The big show. The main event. The main event is on August 6th in Salt Lake City. The theme of the show is Robin.
Embracing uncertainty.
Embracing uncertainty.
Although I think it should be something like having a mad raging affair with uncertainty. But that one didn't win the vote.
Yeah, neither did tongue kissing uncertainty either. That one didn't make it either.
I hate uncertainty. I push it away.
So we're going to have live music. We're starting to get our musicians lined up and our speakers, and it's going to be cool. So if you're in the Salt Lake City area, seating is limited, and tickets will probably go on sale here in about 2 months.
And it's going to be so good. So good. You don't want to miss it.
That's right. Okay, so let's talk about our book. So Carolyn Pearson. So has anybody not heard of Carolyn Pearson? I mean, she is the... I don't know where to place her. She's been in the Sunstone camp for a long, long time. She's faithful. She gets published by, you know, publishing companies that aren't in the state of Utah. She's
in a cherry spot where everyone can love her.
Oh, yeah, cherry spot.
I guess that's
great
what I'm looking for.
Great description, Chris.
Everybody loves Carolyn Pearson.
No, everyone can love Carolyn Pearson. No, I mean, seriously, there's a difference because she's not everyone's cup of tea, and that's fine. But ex-Mormons could embrace her the way she treats homosexuality and the way she respects it, like in her play Facing East. And right. Mormons can forgive her for Facing East because they have My Turn on Earth.
And she has become sort of the church's unofficial ambassador to the gay community.
Which might be why she's still allowed to be Mormon. Because they can say, hey, look, we're not all bastards.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a question that a lot of people have raised is, why is she still in the church? But I've got some things to say about that later as the night progresses.
I asked her that in person once.
Yeah, what was her answer?
Well, that's for a later time. When it comes up later, I'm more than happy to share.
This is the second
tease
tonight. Yeah.
I know.
You know, that's one of my best qualities.
All right. So the book we're doing tonight is...
Goodbye, I Love You.
Goodbye, I Love You, which is published by Random House. So this was a mainstream book, and it got quite a bit of press when it came out. I don't know if it became a bestseller or not, and I don't even know what that means, to be honest with you. The book was published in 1980. Was it 84 or 85?
86, I believe.
He passed away in 84.
Hmm. So the basic premise of the book, because it's the foundation for everything, is Carolyn's husband, Gerald... Mm-hmm. Died in 85 of AIDS. And, you know, they were met at BYU and were married in the temple. And the book sort of goes through her story with Gerald. And I remember as a kid when this book came out and, you know, my family was not connected into like the liberal Mormon scene at all, but this hit mainstream, like people knew about this book and people would generally talk about it in church in a tut-tut sort of fashion, sort of, you know, here's this guy, he left Carolyn, he went out and
look what happened.
Tomcatted around, and then he came back, and she took him in, and he died of AIDS. And it was sort of, the stories that I remember as a kid were sort of this, I told you so, look at righteousness, you know, here he was and he had to come crawling back to, you know, to Carolyn and the gay community, abandoned him and, you know, she had to take him in. That narrative isn't exactly true, but that's the one that I heard about. So this is a book that I know has been in the general awareness of the church, for a long time.
When I found this book, it was on accident in the library because I was looking up her poetry. And so I felt like I hadn't heard about it before. And I picked it up because I liked her poetry. And I read it all like probably within a day. And it was my first introduction to like almost anything homosexual at all. Because growing up, I was very, very innocent and obedient and just straight and narrow. So I didn't even really know about homosexuals at all. And I was probably 23, 24 when I read it. And it changed my life almost immediately. Just having read it, I gave it to my husband and made him read it too. Because I'm like, holy cow, this is such a powerful story. Because to me, it was a kind book. And it was kind towards her version of homosexuality, where she never once said this was a choice. You know, she didn't think Gerald was evil. She didn't think he chose that.
Really?
I don't think, I'm not, no, no, I know. So I can see what you're saying. You think that because she does judge him. But at the time when I was reading it, I was a young Mormon housewife, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm reading this and I'm like, oh, what a kind, like she, I believed that he was choosing it too. You know, choosing to leave her, like, I am so pissed that he had affairs before telling her. That's inappropriate, no matter what. I was thinking of a way to tell you, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and exposing her.
But what I'm saying, though, is like, this was, to me, this was a kind introduction to, like, because it wasn't the typical Mormon statement. I didn't get any of the, She shouldn't have taken him back. He came crawling back to her. Because he didn't come crawling back to her.
No, no. And we'll get there in the story. Yeah, that's not...
Anyway, that's how I found it. And reading it again was really interesting because I'm so different than I was when I was 23.
Oh, definitely. In my experience, I hadn't read this book at all before. And I'm, you know, a word nerd. I have an English degree. I love books. However, I learned very early on, I think it was maybe Tennis Shoes and the Nephites, that like, yeah, Mormons don't write well. And so I had that strong bias for a long time. And that's why I've been so absolutely thrilled with finding Levi Peterson. He is just a stunning, sparkling writer. And so I've decided to give Mormon writers a second chance. And I was so happy to see I was not disappointed in this book by Carolyn Pearson. And I actually did read like a little Christmas book, a short Christmas book she wrote years and years ago. It was so bad. And then I was in one of her plays. And I recognize plays are a little different, but that wasn't very good either. So, yeah, I didn't give her much of a chance. But I'm so glad I gave it a second read because I learned a lot from this book. And... I connected a lot with what she had to say.
Yeah, the book, you know, she published it in 86, and he died, I think, in 85.
84, July 19th.
84. So this was raw.
Yeah.
And that's why I gave you the eyebrow there, because the book is her story through her voice, as all authors mm-hmm. are. So she portrays Gerald as... Well, it's her interpretation of him. And we have no other, you know, I've never read anything that he wrote or anything.
No, and I looked on, there's only two pictures of him, like, on the internet, too. And they're not that great.
Yeah, so.
Because she kept on talking about how cute he was, and I wanted to see.
Right. Yes.
Not so much.
So the fact that it's as fair and loving to him as it is, mm-hmm. given how current the events were, really speaks a lot to her character. So when I give that criticism, I hope it's taken with the love that I intended, that the book is still quite incredible, mm-hmm. but there's obviously a underlying, I don't know the word I'm looking for, like she's not fully accepting of Gerald and his actions. He comes out looking kind of like a bastard through the book, in my mind.
I think he looks a little bit, I was going to say fruity, but that's a bad word for it. He's a little bit, it almost seems like he's really, really deep and really shallow at the same time.
Right.
Because he's super deep and he just wants to embrace life. And you can see this passion and he just needs to embrace life, but he leaves his family.
Right.
And it's hard. It would be hard as a mom to forgive that.
Well, he doesn't keep leaving his family. He keeps leaving everybody. You know, yeah. he ends up leaving all of his lovers. He ends up leaving, you know, so he goes from like one affair to the other. He likes to hang out in gay bars and stuff like that. And that's where I say, you know, I don't necessarily doubt the story, but we're still hearing it through Carolyn's voice. So, he seems like throughout the book, like he's not real good at making, you know, relationships and keeping that sort of bond. And she does juxtapose him. I can't remember the name of the character. There's another individual who enters into the story who is also homosexual, who also sort of left his wife, but then entered into a long-term relationship. And mm-hmm. they have a conversation at the end, you know, and I'm glad she put that in because, you know, there are those stereotypes that say, you know, gay men are just, it's just going to be one score after the other
And they address that in the book even because
yes.
at this point in time, it was one of the, it just... got to be the point where they could actually come out and meet other people, not in the bathroom, you know?
Right.
And so they were like kids in a candy store. Even Gerald said it. You're like a kid in a candy store. And they didn't have very much restraint.
So let's...
That's such a stereotype.
Let's talk about the background of the book. First of all, as somebody who was in that age, people who came of age in the last, I don't know, 10 years don't understand what a big deal AIDS was.
I remember.
It was huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, people were dropping like flies. It was growing exponentially. There was nothing they could do. People were dying in horrible, horrible ways. And when this book came out and when he died, it was at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. And this is another element that makes this book so wonderful because on the right, and I would include Mormons in that, to them it was Judgment Day for the sodomites, right? that there was a lot of strong rhetoric saying this is God's retribution on the homosexuals. You know, because in the beginning, like in the late 70s, it was called like gay men's syndrome or something like that, because it spread so rapidly among the homosexual population and then among intravenous gay, drug users. But man, it was real and it was scary at the time. And that's right when this book came out. And that attitude in the church that it was a, you know, a judgment of God stuck around till what was it, about 89, when the church came out with an official statement saying that they supported AIDS research and that basically said it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a plague from God, that, you know, that we should take care of those people. But for the church members, you know, to even mention, and she hints at that in the book, you know, it was very shameful for her to talk about Gerald having AIDS.
But I think that also makes her come off as a good Samaritan at the end, because she embraces him even though he has the, you know, a dread disease.
Yeah.
And so for like, maybe she doesn't believe that it's a plague from God. And I don't think she did at the time. But even if her neighbors did, they would see that as a good Samaritan. You just help the one that's been punished.
No, and she never implies throughout the whole book, at least I didn't, no. I didn't read that she thought this was, you know, just desserts for Gerald or the anything that any, in any way. And this was in 86 again that she wrote this book. So I think that is a very progressive position that she had.
Very Amen. I think so too, but I think it was, it's a well-timed one too.
Okay, so let's go back in the Wayback Machine a little bit more. Of course, during the 60s is when the birth control pill came out, and we had the whole counterculture movement, you know, and in San Francisco, the whole Hyatt-Nashbury culture, and San Francisco during the 70s became very, very promiscuous. So between condoms and, you know, birth control pills, things like syphilis and gonorrhea were in control, you know, because it's hard to go back to like the 1920s where syphilis was a horrible, horrible way to die. So we, you know, we have the sexual revolution, and for the gay men in the 70s, it was a big party. And so for, you know, Gerald to be there and participating in that, it's, you know, the doors were open to the candy store and everything was
left. That didn't make any sense, too. The way she's the one that chose to move from Utah. She said, I think we can move to California. There didn't seem to be a reason to move to California. They didn't need to for her playwriting. He didn't have a job there. He got a job there. So why choose San Francisco as a woman, knowing that your husband's gay? Why choose San Francisco?
Well, I get the sense she was a little naive about that stuff. And at least she projects herself that way.
But she never once said that it was his suggestion.
I thought she implied, you know, because he had been, you know, he would go to conferences out there and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, she says we can do it from either area. But I got the sense she wanted to move to California to get away from sort of the Utah Mormon culture.
Yes.
Yeah, but definitely. Wow, what a selection.
Yeah, you know, in hindsight, San Francisco might not have been the best choice.
My husband and I were talking about why any logical person would choose that. I mean, if you were trying to keep your husband straight.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at my timeline in my head. She didn't know he was gay when they moved out to California, did she?
I think she did.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's be clear.
Hadn't they already decided to divorce at that point?
So let's talk about the early part of the book. He was, you know, she was in theater.
She knew he was gay before they were married.
Yes, but I don't think she knew what fully meant.
Still, she chose Walnut Creek, like San Francisco. She chose San Francisco.
Yeah, it does seem a strange decision.
And you just said 70s, riot, sexual, everything like that, right?
Yeah, but the Hayden Ashbury era was the 60s. Yeah.
It's an unanswered question.
So
maybe in the next life we'll understand.
Yeah. They were dating, and then he was sort of hot and cold, and I think he disappeared for like 5 months. And, you know, she comes to find out later. Well, I think before they got married, she confessed that he had, you know, had some interaction with other other men. I don't think he came out and said, hey, I'm gay, I'm a homosexual, this is what I am. But he basically said, I love you, I'm struggling with this, but we're going to make it work, you're my choice, da-da-da. You know,
but she knew Paul was his boyfriend, and he lived with his boyfriend.
I don't think she pieced that together till later, I thought.
She was in the theater.
That was my complaint from 10 minutes ago about the book, is I don't think in the book she's fully upfront. She seems to be trying a little bit too hard to make herself the protagonist. And I don't think she's fully upfront with everything she knows. We all go through denial about all sorts of things in our lives. And surely there was some of that going on. But the narrative on how she's interacting with Gerald doesn't always quite make sense to me. But maybe I'm looking at it from 30 years in the future, and, you know, that's really easy. But I think Sinclair in the chat room just says he wanted to love her. I think that's absolutely clear. He did love her. He wasn't sexually attracted to her. He was a homosexual, and, you know,
when they went to the counselor, and the counselor gave him a 4 out of 6 on the homosexuality scale.
On the Kinsey scale, yeah.
Yeah, a 4, which means that you're almost middle of the road. I think he did love her, and he probably enjoyed sex with her just fine. But he had to, in order to feel fulfilled, he really needed a love that was a guy.
And he needed to love himself. So I think that was the biggest driving force.
Guy was ever going to fill that hole.
Yeah, I think that was a big character issue with him, because, yeah, he was looking for this love of his life. What, did I miss something?
No, it was a horrible thing.
I mean, yeah.
Just go on.
Sorry, Chris.
Did you say a hole to be filled?
she said no guy could fill that hole.
Oh, jeez.
You're so immature.
Hey, double entendres.
No, it's a good saying, and you totally took that wrong.
You're the one with the big eyes. I try not to laugh.
So yeah, he told her he was looking for that love that would complete him fully. But, you know, he went chasing after man after man after man, and he would get caught hanging out in gay bars and stuff like that. So I don't know, was that real? Was he just a romantic and not grounded in reality?
Yes,
I don't know.
Absolutely. Romantic and not grounded.
And I noticed that Sinclair also makes a comment about, did he seem a little manic? And wow, that's interesting to imagine that could have been at play in his personality. It certainly seems to fit what I have heard about, like, bipolar or mania. So.
Yeah, and Matt adds that he seemed tortured. And I guess, I mean, that would come from being in the church. You know, as we've talked to other homosexuals who are in the church, you have this fundamental hatred of self that's imposed by the church.
I mean, he had that all the way through the book. Like when he cried at the very beginning of their marriage, I think they were married a year, and he hears a poem. Oh, did he not read a lot? He read a ton, and he read a ton of, like, really sappy kind of stuff. But he heard the poem where about the guy loving...
Was that Longfellow?
Anyway, he's in bed and he's crying about
it. No, Walt Whitman. I'm sorry. I confused my poets.
That's embarrassing. I can't believe you said it out loud.
Longfellow's a real poet.
I know.
Nothing was meant by that.
It was The Buried Life by Matthew Arnold.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, and it kind of hints towards unrequited male love.
Mm-hmm.
And he cries and cries and cries, and she's like, oh, I don't understand why he was crying. And then later on that comes to play, maybe you don't remember, but there's one day I heard this poem and it made me cry. Anyway, yeah, he's definitely romantic, looking for, I think he really was looking for himself.
Well, and I can't imagine what it would be like to be a believer in the church, although it seems like he sort of gave up his grounding in the church very early in their marriage. He was into, like, transcendental meditation and
pictures of auras.
Yeah.
That was hard for me, and
stuff like that. So it seems like he very quickly, his spiritual path diverged from the church. That being said, it would be very, very difficult to maintain that relationship with the church and with that, all that thought process, and not either, you know, completely bifurcate your mind or just have a very low self-esteem.
Yeah, definitely.
You got a hell of a lot of tags in that book there, Robin.
Oh, I sure do.
I've only got five in mine.
I marked this baby up. Yeah, you need a really great pencil, and I finally bought a book for the book club so I could write in it. So
and then
I did.
Wrote on Post-it notes instead of writing. Oh, you wrote the book a bit.
Oh, I wrote in the book, but I put Post-it notes so I can see it on the outside. And before we get going, I mean, too far, because we're talking an awful lot about Gerald. And I, maybe you were saying this was, you know, a lot about Carolyn, and rightfully so. It's her book. But there was an awful lot about her own struggles with women's role in the church. And so it seemed like where her husband fit in is yet again, a man is better.
And she's not good enough. And that's a running theme, is that she feels like women aren't good enough. And then she marries a guy where he openly says, "You're not enough for me. You're not enough woman for me," he says.
I'm glad you guys brought that up, because I think this is the most important message of the book.
I do too.
And I'm on page 61 in my book, which is the very end of chapter 4. And this is where he's talking to her. And Gerald says, he calls her Blossom. "Don't you question things, Blossom? Isn't there anything that you really question that drives you?" "That was easy. Of course you know that, Gerald. I question our view of women. I question why femaleness seems not as valid as maleness. That drives me. I would risk a lot to understand that, to do something about that." There's something in this book that was really poignant to me that I had never considered. You know, we've debated quite a bit on other podcasts and just around the water fountain. When the church will sort of validate homosexuality, when they will accept it. But Carolyn makes a really important point, and that's that women in the church have all of their value in relationship to maleness. Maleness validates womanhood. And like you guys were just saying, it was a struggle for her self-identity, because Gerald picked her, but not for her feminine qualities necessarily. He wasn't attracted to her. He was attracted to men. Now, obviously, he loved her, and they maintained a good relationship their whole life, but not in the way that she needed to be loved by the church.
It was the one thing she had. Like, she felt like this is her sexuality, her womanness,
right.
Her soft breasts. She mentions that a couple times. That was the one thing she felt like she had. That's the one thing her whole life that she'd been taught that she had going for her.
Correct.
Like, women aren't, and I feel the same way. Like, I still have some of that. As I read this book, I still have some of that in me, where they talk about the priesthood. They talk about men's role. They talk about women's role. She talks about her small hands, my small hands, like four or five times. She
right.
mentions how maybe they're not big enough. Maybe they're not good enough. That part was really moving to me.
Well, and to that point, if you know, men have all the power. Men have the priesthood. Men have the authority. Men are the ones who are authorized to talk to God. So God comes through men.
Mm-hmm.
And women, their value in the church comes from men need women. When men no longer need women, when homosexuality is validated, women become nothing in the church. Their one thing is gone.
Yeah, but homosexuals will never have babies.
Well, there's that, but womanhood itself becomes, if homosexuality becomes validated by the church, womanhood itself goes from second class to third class.
Wow.
Because then a man does not need a woman at all.
Even for a relationship.
For nothing, because right now in the church, men need at least need women for salvation. And I think for her underlying theme, being rejected by the male part of her companion, and as a feminist herself, how devastating that was to her, and how hard that would be to deal with.
What a poor choice for Gerald to have picked. I mean, like, this is one woman who really, really cares about women's issues and making sure women feel like they're enough, and she already struggles with it so much, and then she marries a guy who just dismisses her. And her feminine sexuality. Like,
right, her sexuality,
it's just
but not as
her
a
in
human
the pants.
Being.
She's already down. She already feels down. A lot of women felt like they were filling their divine role, that they were just as good. A lot of women felt like, you know, because I remember growing up, I learned that I was just as good as men. That didn't you ever get the story that why do women have children? Because they got to choose first.
I never heard that.
Yeah, because like men have the priesthood because women have the ability to bear children.
Yes, and bearing children is so much better that even then they don't quite catch up.
So there are, but I remember learning that that women were so, it was just like a mother in heaven. She's so holy, we don't talk about her. Women are so awesome and so strong that the men have to have priesthood to kind of make up for that. That's kind of what I was fed as a kid.
Oh, yeah. And some of the women in my life actually tended to take that a step further in that women are better and so much more
holy.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that's sometimes overcompensating because really, I mean, no,
it's
we're
so
not
dismissive.
Treated equally.
It's
we're
so
not
dismissive.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
It's disrespectful. And every time I hear that women are more holy and more spiritual, and that's why whatever. I just, it makes me mad. I hate Mother's Day at church.
Yeah, it sucks.
It's like makes saints out of all women, and we don't deserve that.
It makes saints out of all women by marginalizing some
of
the women.
Yeah, it is.
By saying, oh, you know, we honor motherhood, and those of you who aren't mothers, we honor you too. You know,
there's a poem about that in there, but we digressed.
Well, isn't this whole
show
about
digression?
Yeah, it
really is kind of
digression.
A load about digression.
All right, so there was one other passage where she expresses that thought again. I think it states it probably better than I did. And this is on page 65, a couple pages down. Except for that one area where femaleness, he's talking about this issue about God being a male and not a female, and that rejection of the feminine. And so she says, except for that one area where femaleness really counts, every girl is taught that one day the most wonderful of all things will happen. Her femaleness will be discovered by a man, desired by a man, desperately needed by a man. He will need her because of, not in spite of, her femaleness. To be desired by a man transforms one's femaleness into something good. The bearing of children follows that indispensable and thoroughly feminine marvel. Mm-hmm. And that's that. That vein
yeah, that's
I'm talking
what I,
about the
yeah,
church.
That's what I was talking about. That's what I grew up with. I mean, not those words, but the same kind of idea that my value, my virtue was so important. That was my value.
That you have to be validated by a man, though.
Your
virtue is only realized by some relationship to a man.
I know.
Either a man doesn't take it, or a man takes it at the right moment, or a man, you know.
At the same token, on page 29, third paragraph down, she's talking about how she went out to Europe and she came back and she'd lost her luggage, but she had her passport and her virtue. Right. And then the next paragraph, but boys were weaker. We had always been taught that. Boys were more easily tempted, so it was up to girls to help them resist. Boys were told again and again not to touch girls. And so, like, it's so interesting that somehow we get two messages, you know? We get that the women are holy and the women are virtuous and boys are weak. And at the same time, you get the exact opposite message. Women at this point can't say prayers in sacrament meeting.
Right.
Women can't pass the sacrament. Women can't give blessings anymore. Women can't do all these things. But we're the holy ones? Really? And are we supposed to buy that? No, I'm not bitter.
Oh, yes, I'm not bitter either. So let me share one that really spoke to me. One quote. It's on 68 in my particular copy, which is a few pages into chapter 6. And Carolyn says, "And God's church preferred men. That was evident. Women were welcomed and respected and used, but not preferred. The 100 horror stories I had written out in my diary marched through my mind in sorry evidence. Only last month, a rough cut of a film on Joseph Smith's early life had been shown to the brethren. A scene at the kitchen table had panned the family group and ended on Lucy Mack Smith gazing devotedly at her son. One of the brethren responded, 'Why did that scene feature the mother? It should have featured the father. We are a priesthood-oriented church. We've got to feature the men. I'd like that scene shot over.' No matter how many I heard, those stories hurt anew." That was a shocking story to me. Like, what a bunch of patriarchal you-know-whats.
I have another one about her small woman's hands. "I stared at my hands and turned them over. They were small, a woman's hands." And this is after he gives her the book. Oh, Miracle of Forgiveness.
Oh, yes, that's
a
good one.
She has to read the Miracle of Forgiveness and that's a load. Wow. "I stared at my hands and turned them over. They were small women's hands. Was there something wrong with having a woman's hands? Were big hands better? Was there something wrong with having a woman's face, woman's skin, woman's breasts?" And this is the part. "I sank to my knees and buried my face in the gray couch. What's wrong with being a woman? The cry came from the depths of me. Where could I go to find a healing for the wound to the woman in me? Only to God. But didn't God prefer men too in a spiritual sense? So she's like, found out her husband's homosexual. He's been having affairs. He prefers men. What's wrong with being a woman? And she's praying to God. And she's like, wait a sec. God prefers men too in a spiritual sense. God was male. God associated with males, did business with males, spoke to males, called males to his work. God did not transact important business with people with small women's hands and a woman's face. He loved all of us, of course, but he preferred men. My mind moaned under the weight of it. I mean, what a horrible realization. You find out your husband has been preferring males for a while, and the one comfort you get in religion prefers males too.
Yep. But at least we have vaginas.
Yeah.
There is that.
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, you know, if you say that the woman's role is, you know, I've heard her divinity is in childbirth. And the male, you know, divinity is in holding the priesthood. But in this physical world, women literally get used up in childbirth. I mean, it wrecks a lot of women's bodies, and it eventually stops. You know, women will hit menopause, and they will no longer be able to fulfill that role. Nothing like that is with the priesthood. The men keep growing and becoming and getting more authority and more power and more, you know, and It's just such a destructive teaching to young women, and that's what I think this book really illustrates more than anything, is that play on her concept of her own gender in relationship to Gerald.
I wonder if that was accidental. I know she was a feminist, but really this was her story with Gerald, and it was so much of her life that she was telling it also. But I wonder if she didn't mean this book to be so much of a feminist.
I don't know.
I wonder if she wanted us to think that, or if that was just a side note.
And there's another question there's no answer to this one, but how much of her feminism, and we don't know Gerald, we don't know his mannerisms, and we don't know all that. How much of her feminism attracted her to him in the first place if he rejected, you know, masculine identities?
Are you saying that because he's... because he's not as strong and she could be the leader in the relationship, kind of?
I think attraction is more primal. It's not as conscious as that. But at the same time,
you're attracted to people maybe who aren't patriarchal, like we were talking about. There's so many guys here that are just...
Exactly. And I'm not saying that's bad at all. But no. I wonder how much of that played in from the beginning. You know, the question we had a few minutes ago of how much did she know and understand Gerald's nature?
Yeah, I think that probably had a lot to do with why she loved him so much. Because she would never have been with a guy who said, woman, where is my tea? You know, like, she's not a John Wayne kind of girl.
Right. Yeah, and Heather out in the chat room says, I always had the sense that he was attracted to her because she was artsy and such. And in the book, I got the sense back, you know, and she talks about that he was dynamic and he was radiant and he was an actor and all that kind of stuff, and that led to her attraction. I don't know.
And he really believed in her. I mean, helping her to get her first books published. It sounds like it was very symbiotic, besides the fact that, you know, the sex might not have been the best.
Well, and she didn't complain about the sex.
I don't think this was the book to complain in.
That's probably true.
That's not the story she wanted to tell.
Yeah, I mean, the relationship was important. You can see that struggle through the whole book of her trying to deal with the relationship, because she loved him, and she loved him for what he was, for who he was, despite, you know, what he was in terms of his homosexuality. And go ahead.
But kind of because of what it was. I mean, that's his personality. You can't say in spite of this huge chunk of his personality she loved him.
Right.
She loved him because, like, we met somebody the other week who called herself a fruit fly. She's the kind of woman that just falls in love with gay men, you know? I can totally see Carolyn Pearson as a fruit fly, because she is meeting guys who are, by nature, kind, maybe, you know, softer, kinder. I have to say, some of my best friends are gay too. I love to be around them.
Definitely. And I think
that's a different personality and a different dynamic.
Yeah, and it really is. And on a certain level, I hate to kind of stereotype and put it across the board, but what I found with a lot of my gay friends that I really connect with is at least in this day and age, it's not an easy life to have. And so they have to really go inside and deal with that. And so when they come out of the journey and they become open about their sexuality, they are some of the most open, loving, accepting people I have found.
I just like gay guys because they're hot. All right.
Not all
that's
of them.
That's true.
That's a stereotype.
In their own way.
No, seriously, not all of them. Really.
All right. They're all beautiful inside.
Yes.
All right.
Special spirits of gay guys.
All of us have special spirits.
Okay, so let's go back to San Francisco. So they split up, and he's living dynamically in the community. As a matter of fact, he founded the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus.
He didn't.
He was one of the founding guys in it, was it?
I don't know. He was probably one of the charter members, but I didn't get the feeling that he'd started it.
He was.
Should I break the tie? It sounded like a founder to me, but what
okay,
do
there
I
you
know?
Go.
Yeah. So I mean, that's still around. They had a big thing last year when they recorded True Colors for the It Gets Better project.
Mm.
You never seen that?
I didn't see it. I saw the It Gets Better. I saw a lot of the It Gets Better.
Look it up on YouTube.
But I didn't see the
type in
the choir.
Yeah, it's a moving rendition.
Now tell me if this is something that fits. This might fit in with slightly before the time you're mentioning, because I think it's when he's finally admitting that he is still homosexual, or that he's homosexual, and it's all kind of going on at the same time, and at one point she's preparing for the bicentennial, I believe, and so they put on this show where women wear their wedding dresses and talk about that day when they were married. Do you remember that?
Oh,
and
it so kills
they have,
me.
Yes,
it
they
kills
have this
me. And she said, I wish they would have like pinned a note saying, not that everyone's marriage sucks. It's not true. But to like glorify the wedding, you know, like this is the pinnacle of your life, girls. Let's relive it.
And that's all you have,
and that's
dear.
All you have. And she's like, I wish I could have just pinned a note saying, it's well you know, just to let people know that people struggle. It's hard. It is hard. And the wedding.
Yeah, and she wonders if her description says, and here's Sister Pearson in her lovely crystal gown. Sister Pearson's marriage is in big trouble these days because of her husband's homosexuality. And she cries a lot, and she's hanging in there. So let's give her a big hand.
Yeah, it would have been so moving to hear that, but as a Mormon, young Mormon wife, it would have just embarrassed me not to have that said, about somebody in my presence.
Yeah, and this goes to the point where I think it explains why she stayed in the church. She's going through the divorce, and she's going through the divorce because, you know, her husband's a gay man, and that sort of Mormon dream to go to that point is crumbling. And now by this time, she's become fairly renowned. She published, she's well known, so she gets speaking engagements all the time. And there's one that she kind of gets roped into, and she's going to go speak before 500 women, she says. And she's trying to figure out what to say. And it goes in with this this dress thing. And she realizes that, you know, she's putting up a facade in the church. She's acting stronger than she is. And then she considers the 500 women, and likely they all have their particular thing that they're going through, and that, you know, that we have to sort of work to help each other on that front. And I think that spirit that she's displayed, because she's been very open about her advocacy for homosexuality since then. She's written plays, she's written books, she's written articles. And I really think that's where she found her strength. And after I finished reading the book, I thought, yeah, how could she just, you know, abandon that, something that she had fought so hard for and helped touch so many people in a positive way?
Yes. And she's got a very unique position where she can build bridges. So, you know, even though some people may not agree with exactly, you know, which camps her feet are placed in, she has a unique opportunity for good, and she's doing that.
Well, the church and other conservative entities like it create this environment because, you know, you ask throughout this book, you know, who made mistakes? Both Carolyn and Gerald at the beginning were trying to follow the script that had been laid out for them. And you say, well, Gerald might have been promiscuous, but there was no avenue granted to him to not be that way. And that's the way the church is even today, where it says, oh, well, you can come to church and be gay. You're just going to be celibate. We're not going to allow or legitimize your relationships. When you force the whole thing underground, you can't then say, see, it's a black market underground activity.
Exactly.
You know, because you can't take away the legitimacy, then say it's illegitimate, which is what the church has been doing for years. So, you know, Gerald, in my mind, was trying to make it work the way he'd been taught, but it simply wouldn't work. That's not who he was. He was a gay man, and he could have probably tried to keep it in his pants and make it work, but he would have been miserable. So the two loved each other, and they made a life what they could, but it was because others sort of forced them into something that wasn't them.
Yes. I really love a quote, and of course it'll be paraphrased, from Carolyn Pearson's play Facing East. At one point there's a phrase that says, you know, telling a gay man to live a celibate life is like telling the trees not to bloom. You know, we all deserve love. We all deserve that passionate connection with another human being.
Okay, I just want to say this, though.
Ahead,
I wasn't going to, but I have to say, there's a level where everyone deserves to love someone, and there's everyone deserves that passionate relationship. At the same time, they also had four kids. And I don't, if this were about a man and a woman, and the guy was like, you know, my wife, I just kind of fell out of love with her. And then I met this other woman, and I felt so strongly that I needed to be with her. And so he moved out of the house and he left his kids. Like, I wouldn't, I don't think I'd be as, like, yeah, why is it okay because he was gay, it's okay for him to leave? Why is it because he's gay, it's okay for him to ditch the kids and be promiscuous to the point where he gets diseases? And there were other diseases. Maybe they didn't know about AIDS, but he does really damaging behavior, knowing that he has kids to take care of and he's their dad. And at some point, you got to buck up.
Yeah, that is an excellent point. I do think that Carolyn says that he was a good father, you know, that he did come out around, you know, he was a divorced father, so he wasn't there all the time. And I've heard Emily Pearson, their oldest daughter, talk about that he was a very good father to her, to them. He was promiscuous. He was out involved in dangerous behaviors. That's how he got AIDS in the first place. But, you know, to my point, it's hard because I can't crawl into his head, but I go back to that point that the only way he could fulfill his homosexuality was in the underground. So it's sort of, that's where he like learned his behaviors. You know, that I know I've read some things that talk about male sexuality gets set pretty early. And if you're underground illicit sex, and that's the only way you can get your sexual fulfillment, maybe that sets some switch in their heads. That maybe if that hadn't been the case, Gerald would have been able to have a normal, more healthy life. But
well, definitely. And had homosexuality been an option in his early life, I doubt he would have even been in that relationship.
No, I agree. He already had a boyfriend
and having the children. I think we all know as parents, we screw up an awful lot. And then when we try to mop up the mess, we do the very best we can. And hopefully, you know, the love and our honesty in trying to be true to ourselves and trying to make it right the best way that we can, hopefully that makes it through to our children.
But, Chris, I think Carolyn shares your frustration that, you know, she talks about, well, Gerald said, well, I need to find this love of mine. And he had proposed to her at one point that they stay married, but they basically open the relationship
right. So
he could get a male sort of permanent lover. And she said, well, I can't do that. You know, he was willing to stay with her and stay living there. But she was frustrated that he kept cycling through men over and over and over again, that he wasn't living up to what he said he wanted. So I think to that point, it's like, you know, he says that he needs to be fulfilled as a male, but then again, he's
Right. If this story were told and Carol Ann was the one that decided she needed to be in the theater and the theater happened to be in Europe and she leaves her kids and she visits them once a week and she's a really great mom, like he's a really great dad once a week.
Yeah.
Would you be as sympathetic with her? If she was finding herself in another role and she leaves her husband and her kids?
No, and I'm not real sympathetic of Gerald. I'm just trying to understand it I agree, you know, that I don't understand human sexuality at all. I mean, at all. You know, that almost everybody wants to get a little more action than they're getting or some people do and some people don't. Some people choose not to, you know. Probably in everybody's life, there'll come an opportunity to do something, and a large percentage of people say no because of this stuff. Why does that other side of the population go ahead and do it, knowing what was on the line? I mean, you know, whatever he felt for Carol Ann, I feel more sad for Emily when I read the book.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, to that sort of sacrifice for Emily's sake, you know, where's that?
I know. She was robbed of a dad.
And she was even robbed. I mean, if I understood it correctly, she wasn't even there when he died. They kind of sent the kids off on vacation. And so her last interaction with her father was over the phone.
No, well, she was there not right when he died. But actually, the words goodbye, I love you were to Emily.
But that was on the phone.
Was it on the phone?
Yeah, because she sent him away and she told Emily, it'll just be a week. I promise you, it'll just be a week. But then he came in to live with her and it was 3 weeks later that he passed away and she never brought the kids back, she said.
In defense, when people die of AIDS, it's a very awful way to go. They waste away and I think probably that decision, I wouldn't question the decision to send the kids away.
Really? Absolutely. Oh, no. I mean, I have to respect her as the mom. She's a pretty smart mom. Yeah. And she's done so much, and she's always had her kids around Gerald no matter what. If she chooses not to have her kids around when he's dying, it's not because, you know, it must have been pretty bad.
Yeah, it must have been ugly. I know for the most part, I believe the harshest reality is better than, you know, the softest lie. And kids are a lot more resilient than we give them credit. At least I hope my children are more resilient.
Yeah, I mean, those were, I don't want to second guess. Those are really hard decisions to make at the end there. And you do have to admire her for taking Gerald in. She didn't have to do that. That's very emotionally difficult. But it does speak somewhat to the relationship they have. And, you know, so to kind of round this out, I want to skip to the epilogue. And she's talking about Gerald and all the stuff that's gone, you know, all the cheating that he did, the lying, you know, all that sort of stuff and the hardship, the things we talked about. And at the end, she says this, this is the last page. Gerald and I will have our picnic. I'm planning it now. Our many picnics. After I've traveled the tunnel and been welcomed into the light, I will search the faces for one of my favorite people and he will be there. Gerald and I will walk together and laugh and embrace, sealed as friends forever through years of tears and hopes and joy and devastation and the final precious knowledge of how dearly we still love each other after all the weeping was done. And whoever is in charge of all this will walk with us and will help us sort out the mysteries and help us to complete the healing. Walls will fall and we will see each other more clearly, all of us, the Mormons and the Catholics and the Jews and the Muslims and the straights and the gays and the women and the men. Confusions will lift like fog lifts from the Golden Gate Bridge on a good summer day, and we'll each see our next step and we'll take it. Gerald's insatiable hunger for learning will find ready fields, and I will smile as I see him bounding in with some new bright new knowledge to share, very much as I saw him bounding up the stairs hundreds of times, his blonde hair a rising sun. Blossom, did you know? And, you know, that's idea of heaven that I could embrace, you know, and kudos to Carol Ann for being able to see beyond, you know, just the trite models that were sort of given to us in primary, you know.
Definitely. Definitely. Wonderful woman.
Yeah, definitely. So a great book, and I think it's one that that the influence still resonates out there, that it's still a meaningful message today, even after all this time has passed and things have changed in a lot of ways. All right. Well, as always, the discussion continues. You can head over to our website at mormonexpression.com. You can also, over there on the website, sign up to the newsletter to find out what's going on behind the scenes. And remember that, you know, this is an all volunteer endeavor, and it's made possible by your generous support. So consider getting a subscription or something like that. All right. Good night, all.
Thanks, everyone.
Good night.